Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Chase Thomas podcast. The Chase Thomas podcast. My nephew needs me to record. See, I already hate it.
All right, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Chase Thomas podcast from Still the aforementioned Chase Thomas, coming to you live from Knoxville, Tennessee. Everything School HQ. Also here, up there in
New York City.
It's Fangraphs, not Fangraphs Zone, John Taylor. John, good evening, sir. How are you?
You know, it's finally spring here, which is nice, although it rained today and it was like 50 degrees, because spring is more of a state of mind than an actual existing season anymore. And there's just something about that day when it's like 75 degrees out and it's sunny where you're like, this is true baseball season. This is, I know baseball's been back now for 3 weeks. You know, I've already said a million times, baseball's back, it's good again. But it really is back now that the weather is nice, especially too. You know, it's fully back now that half the Red Sox roster is on the injured list, and I've completely given up any hope that they'd finish anywhere even above 500, much less even really close to it. So we're feeling good. We're feeling great.
I would say it feels like baseball's back officially when the Braves are number one in WRC plus as a team. That's when that's
number one in WRC plus as a team right now.
Hmm?
I'm actually curious who is number it. The Braves are number one in WRC.
Yeah, no. The Braves are number one, John.
Well, it's funny. You look at the top five and you're like, Atlanta, that makes sense. Houston, that makes sense. And then you do the cartoon like, when you see Milwaukee at number three. That's just, I don't know what's weirder. Milwaukee has the third best offense in baseball, or Cleveland has the seventh best offense in baseball. Neither of those two things make any sense to me. The White Sox having the worst offense in baseball. That scans perfectly, though. That feels right.
Oof. I mean, we'll get to the White Sox in a second, which is just a fantastic.
Unfortunately, we are legally required to talk about the Chicago White Sox.
But I think just the fans, like there's some Twitter accounts that I follow that cover or talk about the White Sox and just what they're going through, man. They're having fun with it, though. They're having fun in the misery, which is all you can really do, because
if you don't laugh, you'll cry. And that's just the reality of it.
It's hard, but you got to move forward and just move forward into the darkness, because it's going to be a whole lot of darkness for Chicago White Sox fans, I suspect.
Until Jerry Reinsdorf moves the team to Nashville.
Oh, God, that wasn't necessary. Goodness gracious.
Can White Sox fans even miss this team at this point, or would they welcome that? Would they welcome the sweet release of death?
I mean, I would not. And then I would just like, no, just figure it out. I don't know. But it's also like the whole thing. It's like if Fisher just sold the team to like Joe Lacob today, would the team just like welcome them back to Oakland after all this? Or would Fisher, like, I guess, I don't know. Like, it depends on the ownership. If it's like Reinsdorf is still the owner, you're like, all right, am I really going to miss the Chicago White Sox at a certain point? I don't know. And it's like what is there to miss?
Like, it's, you know,
they were almost really good for a sustainable amount of time this decade, John.
You know, the funny thing is, like, we are now going on, like, what, 8 years since the last good White Sox team? Like, what's the last, or not, no, sorry, not, it's the 2020 team made the postseason, but I don't think I'm alone in feeling like things that happened in 2020 with regards to baseball don't have that same real feel to it. I guess, okay, fine. 2021, they won the AL Central. Before that, the last time, leaving the 2020 season aside, the last time they were, Here are the since the Chicago White Sox won the World Series, here are they've made the playoffs three times in 19 seasons. They have never gotten past the divisional series in any of those three. Obviously, one of them was the shortened series. And with a win-loss percentage of, they're 2-15, although they're currently leading the Royals in game two of their doubleheader today after after losing game one. They come from a head loss, which I think there's going to be, assumes that the Colorado can actually score enough runs to be ahead in any game. But the White Sox are now 2-15, I believe. I'm just going to double check that on MLB.com/standings. Yes, the White Sox are 2-15. That's a 1.18 winning percentage, which translates to a 19-143 record. But here's the good news, White Sox fans. Your expected win-loss total, 3-14. That's much better.
Great.
Going to be throwing a party. And that I should say, over 162-game season translates to 35 wins. Hey, break out the champagne.
Goodness gracious. Well, we'll get into some White Sox shenanigans momentarily, John. But let's start off on a happier note here. Biggest MLB player performance surprise to you to this point in the season is who for you, John Taylor?
I mean, it's tough because I think there's, and understandably so, there is a mindset of you don't really want to try to react to anything either over or under in the first month of the season. There's no real point. That having been said, what Mookie Betts is doing right now is positively bonkers. Not including today's game, which the Dodgers lost, and I don't believe he really did much of anything because it was a shutout. 388, 490, 700, a 510 weighted on base average, a 220 WRC plus. He's already been worth almost two F4 over the course of the season. That is, for a guy who's also, by the way, playing a position he has never played before in the major leagues, or in the minors, I believe, either at shortstop, something the Dodgers had him start doing like a week before the season started. I am never going to get over the Mookie Betts trade. The last words I say on my deathbed will be, I hope John Henry is roasting in hell. It is never going to stop being painful for me that this team, the team I root for, the team I care about, decided that arguably the best player they have ever developed, ever, was just not worth paying money, and that they would rather have Alex Verdugo for some reason. But, you know, if I think about it too long, I'm going to go insane, like in one of those, like, Lovecraftian ways where it's like I've seen the face of an alien god that makes no sense and I just start babbling gibberish for the rest of my life. So we'll move past that. You want to talk about guys who just, I don't think you ever would have expected it. Do you know who has, so here are the top five hitters in WRC plus. I'm going to give you the first four and I want you to guess number five. And this is not including today's games. Number one, Tyler O'Neill at 231, which I think we all knew O'Neill had this gear kind of in him. It's just he's never been able to stay healthy. Obviously, you know, the course of the rest of the season, whether he can stay healthy will be a big determinant as to, you know, how successful it'll be. Number two, Jose Altuve, who just refuses to give in to age, which is just remarkable to me. Number three, Altuve was 230, Betts at 220. Marcell Ozuna at 204 has the fourth highest WRC plus in the league, mashing like he did in his peak Cardinal season. Can you guess, with a 202 WRC plus, who is number five?
I don't know. Who is it?
Jesse Winker.
Oh, I would never have said Jesse Winker.
Left for dead by first the Mariners, and then his absolutely wretched, pointless, horrible season in Milwaukee, where this is what he did in Milwaukee over 197 pointless plate appearances. He hit 199, 322, 47 with a 269 weighted on base average and a WRC plus of 65. That was good for a WAR of negative 0.8. Now all of a sudden 373, 500, 608 with a 485 wOBA for the Nationals right now. Where did this come from? And like, look, Winker in Cincinnati at the start of his career before he got traded to Seattle. And I think I should say Winker was fantastic in Cincinnati. I think when he got traded to Seattle, there was probably an expectation he was going to take a dip because Seattle's not really a place you go as a left-handed hitter who has kind of mid-tier power, which is what Winker had or has still, I should say. Things completely fell apart there. Combination of injuries, underperformance. It seems like particularly in Seattle, he was not particularly well liked within that clubhouse. There was a lot of kind of late season sniping about him and his work effort or lack thereof. To me, like this dude was so bad last year that it really, one, it felt like, okay, well, he's probably done in baseball because who's going to bother after two seasons like that if he's already also got a bad clubhouse reputation? And two, it felt like when the Nationals signed him, it's like, well, yeah, of course, that's the only team that would bother with a guy like Jesse Winker. No one else has, there's no point. But what we're seeing with Winker now is the same very good eye at the plate he's always shown. He has cut back down on the strikeouts. And again, it's early. You don't want to overreact to anything, particularly because he's putting the ball on the ground a ton, which is usually not the pathway to success. But he is he's hitting the ball hard. He is barreling it consistently. He is, again, he has cut down on the strikeouts. He has cut down on the swings and misses. He is making far more contact generally, despite swinging less, which is obviously a great thing. You want that kind of balance of swinging less, but making impact contact when you do swing. You know, again, it is early. Jesse Winker is probably not going to finish top five in WRC plus for the rest of the season, but absolutely astonishing to see him. There are a few other names that stand out just on the early going. Justin Turner, who is almost 40 years old and is still raking. One of those guys who, just as long as he's healthy, he will hit. Don't ask him to do anything else, but he will hit. Mike Trout, similarly. Obviously, no one is going to come out and say that Mike Trout is a bad player, but I think there were a lot of concerns that all the accumulated injuries over the last years had taken him down from what had been his usual peak. As of right now, he's got a slugging percentage of almost 700, a weighted on base average of 439, and a WRC plus of 190, looking very much like his usual dominant self. Bobby Witt Jr. showing that last year was not a fluke, or at least that level of performance feels sustainable for him. Michael Busch, who has six home runs, homered in five straight games in the process, I think has been.
And that's a weird one. Can we talk about Busch? Because like,
sure. Let's talk about Mike
Busch. Like, he was a throwaway, and it was like one of those things that got lost in a deadline deal for the Dodgers that I don't think Friedman.
It was a deal this offseason where they basically dumped him on Chicago to try to clear some roster, some 40.
Yes, but they did not want to move Michael Busch. He was kind of blocked, obviously, in Los Angeles. I think that was like one of those sneaky ones because he was a high. Like, I think he was a. He would have been good. I would not have been surprised.
First round pick in 2019 out of UNC. Right. He was a top prospect for them coming up through their system.
And now, like, he's in a much better situation. He's not blocked. He has more opportunity to grow and learn and not on like a win now at all cost team. Like, I'm not surprised that Busch is actually raking in Chicago. And I think that was like one of those under the radar, like sneaky good signings this offseason. And it was
I think most people agree it was a great trade for Chicago to get a potential MLB contributor for two minor league players, along with Yency Almonte, who.
Well, they also had leverage, right? Where the Dodgers needed to move space. And well, yeah, you're like, hey, and, like, if you want to move space, then give us Michael Busch.
As you noted, like, this was for the Dodgers about clearing 40-man roster space. And like you said, in a guy like Busch, who not a great defender at any real place in the infield, would have had to be either a first baseman or a DH. Obviously, when you have Freddie Freeman at first base and Shohei Ohtani at DH, that's not a position you really need anything else for. But hey, the Dodgers roster crunch was the Cubs' gain, and he's been huge for them, particularly as Cody Bellinger has struggled, and they've lost now Seiya Suzuki likely for the next month to an oblique strain. And I think in a similar vein, young guys who really stepped up and given production to a team that's needed it. Anthony Volpe for the Yankees, who looked hopeless for large stretches of last season, has made some big swing changes. I encourage people to go to Fangraphs, read Esteban Rivera's piece on Volpe and the changes he's made. It's great. Esteban is a number one when it comes to breaking that stuff down. Now hitting again before today's game against Toronto, 349, 438, 508 with a 422 weighted on base average and a 183 WRC plus. And he's doing great defensive work at shortstop. You're seeing why people were so high on him as a minor leaguer and as a prospect. Great start to the season for Volpe so far as a young guy. I think and one other name I want to mention is Mitch Haniger, another dude I think similarly in the mold of Turner and Trout. As long as he's healthy, he's going to hit. Obviously, the big issue with him is the staying healthy part, but so far so good for him. He has looked rejuvenated with Seattle, coming back there after a pretty lost stint in San Francisco. So And that's been a big one too for the Mariners, because if there's one thing they've really lacked over the last few years, it's been that kind of middle of the order bat to help Julio Rodriguez, to help the rest of that roster. So big thing, big one there for Seattle is to have Haniger healthy and raking.
Yeah, and we'll see if that ultimately happens. But, you know, a lot of good starts around the league. A lot of surprises, some not surprises like Mookie, yeah. But we'll see.
And I was going to say, I mean, I've only hit on the hitter side of things. You know, yeah. You look at the pitching side of things, meanwhile, just by war, I mean, the leader in F4 right now in the major leagues is another name you probably never guess, Cutter Crawford. Garrett Crochet.
Great baseball name.
Yeah, Cutter, great, great baseball name. Garrett Crochet, back from injury and healthy, has been outstanding for the White Sox. Reed Detmers has looked very good for the Angels. Yusei Kikuchi has shown a big step forward in strike throwing for the Blue Jays. He was great last night on Tuesday night against the Yankees. Your boy Reynaldo Lopez has had a fantastic start to the season for the Braves. Huge, obviously, with...
Brutal for the White Sox.
Brutal. What isn't brutal for the White Sox? Huge, obviously, for the Braves with Spencer Strider down. In a similar vein, Ronel Blanco has really gone a big way toward stabilizing the Astros, or at least helping them from sliding into complete hell with his strong start to the season so far. I mean, that's a dude I don't really expect to keep that up. Not a big strikeout guy. A batting average on balls in play of 118, which helps explain why his xFIP is 469 right now. You know, that's not exactly a good sign, but he's been great for them so far when they've really, really needed him. And I think this is not so much a surprise if you are a prospect guy or you watch in the spring, but Jared Jones in Pittsburgh looking like the second coming of Strider, just pure like 100-mile-an-hour fastballs and wipe out sliders. That's all he does. He was completely unhittable against the Mets.
But also, pitch him more. He threw like 50-something pitches today.
59 pitches, which I understand, and there's probably a tangent here to go with the Pirates, because I understand if you're the Pirates, you want to protect your young pitchers, you know, which is why you have a guy like Jones, you know, throwing only 5 innings in that game, and why, despite the fact that they've, you know, the Pirates have lost Marco Gonzalez, the injury list, they haven't already called up Paul Skeens. The Skeens one, I think, is harder to understand, because if there are only so many bullets in a pitcher's arm, why are you wasting them in AAA at a level where that guy is clearly just has nothing left to prove and demonstrate? I think similar to Jackson Holliday in the 10 or so days he spent down there. I think there, and it's something we talked about last week and kind of continues here, is there has, I think, you know, there is something admirable to be, or it's admirable to try to keep your pitchers healthy and to want to keep them healthy. But at the same time, there has to be an understanding, I think, that no matter what you do, pitchers are going to break. You know, like we said, particularly with Yuri Perez, who blew out his elbow and had to undergo Tommy John surgery, the Marlins did every single last thing in their power to keep him from throwing too much, to limit his exposure, to try to manage his innings, manage his pitch count, manage the stress of major league pitching, and it still was not enough. You know, there is just no way to guarantee that stuff. And if you're a team like Pittsburgh, where every single win, every single loss is theoretically at least that much more important in your contention hopes, you've got to let these guys go. Like, Pittsburgh lost that game last night in part because it pulled Jones after just 5 innings and had the bullpen give that game away. Similarly, you know, you're leaving wins on the table by having guys like Luis Ortiz pitch instead of Paul Skeens, or you know, however Pittsburgh wants to go forward with Gonzalez's rotation spot right now. So, you know, I get that there's probably a feeling with the Pirates that, you know, this is not a contending team. There's no need to push these guys, you know, just let them develop, let them, you know, take, you know, be careful with them. There's no need to push. But on the other hand, when you have two absurdly good pitching talents like this, who can single-handedly make you a contender, it's kind of hard to say that, you know, that this kind of prudence really should kind of overtake everything else, especially because as I just said, even that level of caution doesn't guarantee anything in the long run. I think for a lot of, and it just sucks to understand, but like a lot of teams probably just need to go into this with the idea of, hey, this pitcher we love, at some point or another, we're going to lose him for 18 months. You know, they're going to blow out, because this is just the nature of pitching. It is just going to destroy your arm, particularly if you're a guy like Jones, who's throwing 100 miles an hour with, you know, high spin sliders. Like it happened to Strider. It's probably going to happen to Jones. It's going to keep happening until something changes with regards to the way guys are developed. But for the time being, it's just, especially as a Pirates fan, it must be frustrating to have Jones, to have Skeens, and to feel like, you know, why are we not getting more out of these guys when they're here? Especially, too, because if you're a Pirates fan, you know, it's like, well, we're not signing these guys long-term to anything. the second they hit free agency, they're gone forever. If they don't get traded before then, you know, what does it really matter how much care we take or how we take care of them to a certain degree?
Absolutely. Well, speaking of good starters here, John Taylor, yes. Clairvoyant John back this week.
Ooh,
the Royals, as of this recording, are 11-6. And I ask you, will they stay the course around above 500, a couple games above 500? And do you think the starting pitching is legit and will carry over the remainder of the season?
So we'll start with this. The place I always want to start when it comes to assessing a team, you know, start, be it hot, cold, somewhere in the middle, is you look at the expected win-loss based on run differential.
I think they're one, right?
They are number one in the league in run differential, plus 41. Expected win-loss of 13-5 compared to an actual record of 12-6. So this is not a team that's playing above with its head above water, I think, in a way that a similar AL Central team like the Tigers is, where you just feel like that's a team that's just kind of getting lucky a little bit.
I think the Guardians are number two, right?
Amazingly, the AL Central is the place to be. You are correct.
As we predicted. Guardians,
plus 38. Yeah, as we predicted, the two best teams in the American League are in the AL Central. So just to start there, what the Royals are doing does feel legit in that sense. More than anything, though, it hasn't been the pitching. It's been the offense. Like, this team is number two in the American League in runs scored at 90. Number four, actually. They have 91 runs scored. The Orioles are tops with 104, then the Guardians, then the Rangers, and then the Royals just ahead of the Yankees. So a top five offense, at least in terms of runs scored. Similarly, I think as we just noted in getting started with this, in terms of team overall offense, the Royals are they're 10th in the league in WRC plus at 107. They are 13th in the league in weighted on base average at 323. So you could argue that there's actually been, despite a little bit of underperformance, they still made a score, a good amount of runs. Some of that is just, it's kind of a boom and bust offense, which I think is what you should probably expect when you're running kind of swing first, think later guys like Sal Perez and Michael Garcia and MJ Melendez. And, you know, there's not a lot of patience in this lineup, but there is an ability to mash between Perez, Vinny Pascantino, Bobby Witt Jr., Melendez, Hunter Renfroe, although he's been off to a terrible start, Nelson Velasquez. Like, this is not a team that's going to finish top half the league in on-base percentage, but this is a team that can actually do some damage from up and down the lineup. There are a few weak spots that they probably want to think about. Renfroe in particular at 32 years old, never really been a guy I think you can rely on full-time. A genuine question whether or not that's something the Royals want to go forward with full-time in right field. Similarly, at second base, Adam Frazier has really not looked good the last few years. That felt more like we just have to fill second base somehow, so let's just get this guy. I wonder whether or not that's something the Royals will look to try to upgrade going forward, but onto the pitching side of things, I think Cole Ragans has already demonstrated that the stuff is legitimate. It's just a matter of whether he can stay consistent and healthy. That's been the case so far. Brady Singer, obviously the big deal with Singer is that he has, and look, Singer, a guy who's struggled a lot in the past, after a very, very solid college career, after being a first-round draft pick, the big change for him obviously has been, the big change for him has been really embracing the slider and the four-seamer at the expense of his sinker, which was a very bad pitch last year. You know, changing up the pitch, changing up the arsenal, changing up the approach has been a really big and good thing for him. So he's been. And even if he's not, you know, he has a 4.26 ERA plus right now, although that's before today's start against the White Sox, where he was fine. That's obviously not going to continue going forward, but that's not what the Royals need, even. They have an ace already in Ragans. What they need in Singer is to be able to produce that kind of just six innings, two or three runs to start, quality starts on a regular basis to help make up for the fact that the bullpen is probably the weakest unit on this team right now. And the fact that there isn't really pitching depth that they have available to them. You know, part of the reason I think signing Seth Lugo and signing Michael Wacha, though those guys don't really have high ceilings, was so important for them was to shore up that lack of depth that they had last year, when it just seemed like they were throwing anybody with a pulse out there to make a start. You know, not the case so far this year, especially because, like I know, there's not, you know, you look at what the Royals do have in terms of pitching depth, there's not really a whole lot there. You know, it's guys like Daniel Lynch, and somehow Zach Davies is on this team. Really? Wow, that's depressing. Or not on this team, in this organization, I should say. You know, Daniel Lynch, who has struggled badly in his major league career to date. Davies, who is very much more of a back of the rotation innings eater guy. Luis Sessa in a similar vein. You know, the prospects, especially, and I should note, you know, eventually the job at second base, just to backtrack a little, you know, right now it's Adam Frazier. I imagine the hope is that maybe Nick Lofton can take that job, who's the Royals' current top prospect. But, you know, but as I was saying, there's not really available pitching depth. You know, the number one pitching prospect the Royals have at the moment is, scanning through Fangraph's roster resource list, is probably Frank Mazzucato or Ben Kundra down in High A. You know, those guys obviously aren't anywhere close to the majors and aren't going to be anywhere close to the majors this year either. They're not going to get there. So for Kansas City, I think the biggest thing in order to keep this hot start going is these guys have to stay healthy, because beyond Ragan, Singer, Lugo, Waka, and Alec Marsh, there's really nothing. There's Jordan Lyles, and that is sad. You know, you don't want to be in a position where you have to start Jordan Lyles every fifth day. So, you know, I like what Kansas City's start has looked like. It feels legitimate. A lot of it, I think, is just they've been able to play the White Sox a lot, which obviously doesn't hurt. But, you know, they've seemingly addressed one at least of the biggest problems they had last year, which was the rotation. That was awful. It's been a lot better this year. How healthy those guys stay, I think, is going to be the big determining factor as to how good the Royals are going to be the rest of the way. The good news, though, is they've already upped their playoff odds significantly since the start of the season. Dan Szymborski wrote a quick piece about that on Fangraphs. People should check out that the Zips projection system is full in on Ragans, full in on Witt as having hit a new level of production. You look at where the Central is right now. All three of the Twins, Guardians, Royals projected to finish somewhere between 81 and 82 wins, with the Tigers right behind at 80. So the Royals are right there in that conversation. They have better playoff odds right now than, among other teams, the Angels, the Red Sox, the Mets, the Pirates, the Reds, the Giants. Like, this is, I think, for the time being, a semi-legitimate AL wildcard contender and definitely a semi-legitimate AL Central contender. It really is, I think, going to come down to health for them.
It's just funny, like, some of these franchises where the rebuilding is just so hard to predict. Like, you just leave some where it hasn't worked for so long. The Royals haven't been able to get out of the muck. We've left them for dead. We weren't the most optimistic on this podcast talking about the Royals' 2024 chances. And we were talking about the Tigers, and the Tigers look like they're going to be a good team in the AL Central. But it's kind of cool to see that, like, some teams are just... It's just weird. It's just like, it's so silly to just be like, that's baseball. But the Royals just breaking out of the muck and breaking out of this horrible cycle, this decade long cycle. It's just that's baseball. Sometimes it just happens like this.
Well, and it's a testament to being active in free agency and using it to address your biggest holes. Like, the biggest problem the Royals had last year was starting pitching. So what do? They went out and got two guys in Seth Lugo and Michael Waka, who are by no stretch of the imagination aces, but are useful, dependable, middle of the rotation guys who can give you 160 plus innings. And most importantly for the Royals, mean you don't have to just throw Daniel Lynch or Jordan Lyles out there every fifth day and let them get their brains beat in, you know, because you don't have any better options. They understood that, hey, pitching depth is a weakness on this team. We can address it very easily through free agency. All it's going to cost us is money, which we have plenty of because our payroll is low, because we're, aside from Bobby Witt Jr., we have no long-term commitments really to anybody. So again, like we said it then, I'll say it now. Kudos to the Royals front office for actually going out and making moves to up the floor of this team, understanding too at the same time that it was not going to take much to be in contention for the AL Central, especially given the quiet offseason the Twins had and the bad injury luck they've had as part of it, and the fact that Cleveland basically didn't do anything all offseason either. So, you know, it was a savvy winter to a certain degree for the Royals.
Fun stuff. For Kansas City fans, I like it. Speaking of fun stuff and fun, you know, surprises around Major League Baseball here, John Taylor, Jackson Holliday called up for the O's in the last week. Most intriguing part for you to his game, and what do you like most about, or what are you most curious about with how he fits in with the rest of the Baltimore lineup?
Well, I think with fitting in, it's where does he play ultimately? He's a second baseman right now. You know, the Baltimore infield isn't just a kind of perpetual flux because it feels like there are just so many. It's like what Cincinnati was before everyone started getting hurt, where it's like They seem like they have too many guys for too few positions. In this case, you know, Holiday's natural position or the position he was drafted at was shortstop, but they have Gunnar Henderson there right now in Baltimore. Third base, they're trying Jordan Westberg there. They have Kobe Mayo down in the minors, who's probably going to be up at some point this summer, depending on how things go with that infield. You know, but I think for me, the biggest thing with Holiday is this kid's not even 21 years old right now.
Yeah.
You know, he's played like a grand total of like 80 games in the minors. You know,
just goes like this, though.
Well, that's the thing. It's like what's kind of scary to me about Holiday and all these other kids at this point, Wyatt Langford, I think, in a similar vein, and Jackson Chourio, though I know Chourio's gone off to a slow start. These are kids. Like, this is not normal. What has happened with Major League Baseball in the last decade or so, especially, and I think Juan Soto was probably the apex of it, but, you know, it's still playing out today, is all of a sudden 19, 20, 21-year-olds coming and just hitting the ground running. And granted, that hasn't necessarily been the case for Holiday, who is not, you know, great. It's been a tiny, tiny sample size of just six games so far, not counting today's game, but he has hit very, very poorly. It's really proving this, you know, no matter how good you are, no matter how talented you are, the adjustment to the major leagues is a very difficult one. But I think when it comes to Holiday, what I'm looking for first is the defense is, you know, can he stick at second base? Can he make that a position? Can he make that his position? Because the Orioles don't really have options there unless they want to move Westberg back there and try Mayo at third base. I don't get the sense that Jorge Mateo is a guy that they want to run out regularly, given his, you know, he's not much of a hitter. He's really more of a glove and speed guy. He's a very good defender and a great runner, but, you know, not a dude I think you want to give 500 plus plate appearances to. Reading off of, I recommend folks go check out Holiday's scouting report over on Fangraphs from Eric Long and Hagen. It's a big one. It's great. You know, there's nothing really, I guess that's kind of the thing with Holiday. There's no real weakness here. There's no real main issue you can point to throughout his admittedly short professional career and go, oh, well, that's going to be an issue going forward. He has shown a plus hit tool, plus power tool, plus speed. That's why I think the fielding is the one you really look at. You know, the expectation and hope is that he can be a starting shortstop, but, you know, the Orioles are going to have to put him at second base for right now because they want to keep Gunnar Henderson where he is. You know, it's just going to be a matter of, you know, when, if ever, do they want to make that adjustment? What is it going to look like? I'm really excited to watch because, again, it's so wild to get a kid 20 years old. And he's such a baby face too. You watch him come to the plate and you're like, what is this bat boy doing coming up here? It's phenomenal stuff. And again, like, he's off to a slow start, but again, he's not even 21. It's crazy. You know, this is a guy who's projected to be like an all-star level MVP caliber player in his peak. I'm really excited to see the tools he shows up once he starts getting more comfortable at the major league level.
And the Orioles just have to slow down with this now, right? Like, there's just so many dudes now, so many young guys. Like, Orioles, all right, can there be any more?
There are. I mean, again, that's the thing. Like, you look, Colton Cowser's gotten off to a ridiculous start for that team.
Yeah.
I just mentioned Kobe Mayo down in the minors. Similarly, Heston Kjerstad. Heston Kjerstad, Samuel Basalo down in Double A. You look at that Triple A Norfolk lineup; it's probably the best minor league team in professional baseball right now, and that's without Holiday any longer. Like, frightening the level of player development the Orioles have achieved with their hitters.
Oh man, Orioles, they're in good shape, but those fans, they deserve it. I'm glad the Orioles, and also Cedric Mullins had a crazy catch I sent you this week.
He had a walk off home run today.
Did he really? I didn't see
that. He did. Goodness big game for Cedric Mullins. This is a pro Cedric Mullins podcast.
Absolutely. And I feel like they should have, like, for the Orioles going through this, team should be able to, like, I don't know, Adam Jones should be allowed to just be like just come whenever and hang out in the clubhouse and get to watch stuff whenever he wants during this run of, like, Trey Mancini's allowed back, where you just bring certain guys who've seen the worst of the worst in Baltimore. And it's like, no, you get to come back for a little bit of this. If you want to come through, Nick Marquez, you're retired. Hey man, you've put in a lot of grind for us.
Bring Melvin Mora back and let him soak in this feeling.
Absolutely. Miguel Tejada. Buy or sell, John Taylor. Cleveland is number two, as we talk about in run differential at the moment. Will they be one of the best in run differential by the end of the season?
So I'm tempted to say no, because the feeling with Cleveland is always, but how are they going to keep scoring runs? Because they seem allergic to the concept of having good hitters.
Yeah.
For so long, it's just been Jose Ramirez. And what's actually, I think, funniest to me about how good of a start Cleveland's off to, Ramirez has been bad so far. 101 OPS plus on the season, a sub 700 OPS. Really hasn't looked right at the plate so far. But they've overcome that with a great start to the season from Stephen Kwan, great start from Josh Naylor, very good start from Andrés Giménez, who was on and off struggling last year. David Fry out of nowhere, Gabriel Arias similarly out of nowhere, Esteban Florial. I think what makes this feel, what that makes that feel at least less, less sustainable is I don't really bet that guys like David Fry and Esteban Florial and similarly, like Stephen Kwan's has been a very good hitter in his short major league career so far. But I don't really bet there's any reason to think that Arias and Florial and those dudes have found some new level. Like if there's going to be sustainable production in Cleveland, it's going to have to come from Jose Ramirez. It's going to have to come from Josh Naylor, who's also off to a tremendous start. It's going to have to come from Giménez. Those are going to be the engines. But I think what's also important with Cleveland is Florial and Arias and Fry don't have to be superstars. They just have to be acceptable, you know? And I think that's an area where Cleveland has too often fielded lineups with just no useful hitters beyond Ramirez and like one or two other dudes. If these guys can at least hold their own, that goes a long way. I think also what I'm similarly worried about is with Shane Bieber out and with Tristan McKenzie off to a terrible start and with Gavin Williams still hurt and with Tanner Bibby. Bibee off to a slow start, is where is the pitching going to come from? You know, the bullpen has been great. It's been the savior, I think, of Cleveland season so far, but who is that number one starter going to be for them if it's not going to be Bieber? You know, McKenzie looks completely off. You know, I think there has to be something physically wrong with him. He has 12 walks in 13 innings so far. I don't know what Cleveland plans on doing about that, but they have to figure something out there. You know, again, Williams is still hurt. Bibee has been fine, but I don't think was expected to be a guy to kind of take that number one mantle. It looked more like a projected kind of mid-rotation starter. Similarly with Logan Allen, more of a pitch to contact dude than a strikeout artist. And then at the bottom of the rotation is Carlos Carrasco. Amazing that he's actually here. I honestly thought he had retired a year ago. when he signed with Cleveland in spring training, I had figured it was one of those, oh, you're going to sign here and get a one-day contract so you can retire as a Guardian. That's cool. Like, it's always nice when a player does that and a team does that. But instead, he's actually, you know, out here making starts. He's been shockingly good for them so far, but you know, with a walk rate of 6.4 per nine and at 37 years old throwing 89 miles an hour, I struggle to see how that's going to work out long term. And then I think similar to Kansas City, Cleveland is not a team that really has high tier pitching reinforcements coming. All their major top prospects are either hitters or way, way down in the minors. Their number one pitching prospect at the moment is, take a moment, just, you know, play some elevator music in your head before we figure this out. I mean, it theoretically it's Daniel Espino, but his career has been so derailed by injuries that I don't really know what, if anything, can be expected. I mean, regardless, he's not going to pitch the season anyway. You know, their number one pitching prospect beyond the guys they have up in the majors already, probably Parker Messick down in high A, Welbin Francisco, he's a position player. So probably Parker, what name did I just say? There we go. Parker Messick. I was going to say Parker Mendick, but that's Danny Mendick. So again, not a team that is going to be getting reinforcements from the minor leagues. The only real reinforcement coming here is eventually Gavin Williams. So yeah. I similarly worry about with Cleveland is the starting pitching depth is not there. They lost their number one starter already. And this is not a team that really goes out and makes big trades or makes big moves. It is not a team that likes to push the envelope like that. I'm a little more bearish. I always get this wrong. Which one is positive and which one is negative? Bearish and bullish.
Bearish is negative. Bullish is positive.
All right, so I had it right the first time. Yeah. I'm more bearish on Cleveland just because...
Which is not okay, because I'm a big bear guy, and I don't think bears deserve that. I don't think bear, like that, they should have a negative connotation in this one.
Yeah, what is with big zoology deciding that bear is bad here?
I don't know. maybe the brown bear. They're just not as fit. Like, do you know the rule, John? If you're hiking, what's the rule of brown and black bear?
You make noise at one and like you run the fuck away from the other. I can't remember.
No, you don't run from either. So, okay. John Taylor, don't hike anytime soon. Yeah, we got some work to do before you hit the Appalachian Trail.
Not a problem for this city boy.
No, it's brown, get down. Black, fight back.
Okay, so I love the idea that if you're confronted by a black bear, the advice is just punch it. that's something I'm going to be able to do while I'm not busy crapping my pants in fear.
No, I mean, there's a lot of black bears. Like, black bears don't really want the smoke. That's what it's basically telling you. Like, the black bears really don't want... They're just little... Like, they just like want sharks. Trash.
The reputation hides the fact...
They're big raccoons. They're very big raccoons, is okay. What black bears are.
Yeah, I mean, they like digging through trash. People think they're cuter. People think they're very cute.
I love black bears. And brown bears, you're in some trouble, like, because you can't really, like, you gotta get down, you gotta hope that they just don't care. It's basically the end is you're just going down, you're not gonna outrun them. It's tough. Like, the brown bear, you're in some trouble. Grizzly, you're in some trouble. Black bear, you'll be all right.
Yeah, polar bear, sorry, you're dead.
You know what's polar bear's actual color is?
What's that?
They're black or brown. I think they're black under if you take them out of the climate and you shave them down. I think they're black.
Oh, how about that?
Yeah, I think black. Yeah, I think it's black.
Well, if you would like to shave a polar bear and let me know for sure.
Yeah, they're black. They're black under their fur.
Okay, good to know. Well, yeah, bearish on
all kinds of great facts here, folks.
welcome to the Steve Irwin podcast, where we're just dispensing animal facts.
It would not surprise no one to know that I have a bear book, and I love I love bears. Asheville. I love bears. I'm so
this is hot. This is an earth science friendly podcast.
I love earth science, man.
We love Cedric Mullins. We love bears.
We love bears. We don't like mountain lions. Mountain lions also.
We're not about mountain lions. They'll mess.
They're fast and they are mean and
they're angry.
No, mountain lions. There's
cats.
Yeah, don't go down the rabbit hole. Like, there's just so many California situations where it's like mauled down by some mountain lions. Like, you're going down.
Way to go.
That's pretty brutal.
Imagine getting a police officer come to your door and say, "I'm so sorry, but your loved one has been killed by a mountain lion." Just have that moment of like, "Excuse me?" I'd be like, "What kind of silly like prank is this? Like, is this freaking what was that show with Ashton Kutcher where he would just
punked?
Yeah, look around for the cameras. And be like, am I being punked right now?" And the police officer would be like, "Sir, that show has been off the air for ages."
Well, they're remaking everything, and they're just get into a whole conversation about no one makes anything anymore, and it's like, hold on, we've lost track of what the original conversation was.
Cue Frank Sabatka. We used to make shit in this country, build shit.
We used to have starters throw 60 pitches.
Well, that, I mean, though, there's the problem for Cleveland is, you know, they're already down one really good starter.
What a way to bring it all the way back, John. What
a hell of a segue, right? They're already down one. They're already down their best starter in Bieber. There's something clearly wrong with the guy they expected to be their second best starter in Tristan McKenzie. You know, they really need to figure him out. They really need to get Gavin Williams healthy. Until and unless both of those happen, I'm going to fade the Guardians going forward, particularly because, again, this is not a lineup I think you can expect to be producing on the regular, barring guys like Arias and Florial and Will Brennan. And Brian Rocchio taking huge steps forward to help out the already existing main cast.
Goodness gracious. Your favorite part of this very podcast, John? Red Sox talk.
Oh, God.
Trevor Story's out for the season. We haven't talked about this yet.
What a shock.
Goodness gracious.
Like, who, what was the over-under on game Story played this season? Like 40? I don't know that number would have had to have been like 5 for me to take the under. I don't actually know if Story even made it 5 games.
I don't think
he did. I think he played 4 games this season. He played 8 games this season. My apologies to Trevor Story.
Where does he rank like in terms of all-time worst Red Sox signings in your lifetime? Where does
signing on that roster right now? That honor belongs to Masataka Yoshida, who is basically late career Eric Hosmer at this point. Heim Bloom might be the worst evaluator of major league talent I've ever seen in my life. I don't think he's gotten a single signing right.
Did he not get one?
Minor dudes like Adam Duvall, you know?
Braves legend.
Braves legend Adam Duvall. No, I mean, story isn't as bad as like Carl Crawford or, you know, or who's the big one I'm probably missing? Hanley Ramirez, Pablo Sandoval. Dear God, Pablo
was a bad one.
It's great. Heimblum was to an extent just the Ben Sherrington like redux, which boy, that.
But now Ben Sherrington out here revitalized in Pittsburgh.
I'm starting to think that there are guys like Sherrington and Bloom who just do not belong at like big time clubs, which is funny to say because Boston does not operate like a big time club anymore. But regardless, like they just seem to be better suited to working in the margins away from the spotlight where nobody really cares and where there's not even the temptation or possibility of making a big signing. It's for as much as I'm crapping on Story. There are two things about his loss for the season that are so damaging long-term for the Red Sox. The first is just that this is a team that last year without Story had no answer at shortstop, and without him this season continues to have no answer at shortstop. It was a total black hole for the lineup last season, and will remain so going forward unless Marcelo Mayer, their top infield prospect, blows up in Double-A and forces the issue by midsummer. The bigger issue to me, though, is defensively. Because Story, for as much as he just seemingly could not hit anymore, or at least was intermittently hitting, was still a phenomenal defensive shortstop. And that, I think, is a bigger problem, because the drop-off from Trevor Story to the combination of David Hamilton and Romy Gonzalez, and I guess I'll give Sedan Rafael some credit. He's a good defender no matter where he plays. But it's a real steep drop. And it has such a huge impact on the rest of this roster defensively, or the rest of the infield defensively, I should say. It's just bad. It's bad all the way around. It's a loss that, to say nothing of the fact that I think if you were looking for offensive ceiling on this team, and it really did feel like there were not a whole lot of guys you could look at and go, oh, well, you know, that's a guy I expect is going to just suddenly take off. A lot of the theoretical offensive ceiling for this lineup was going to come out of someone like Story playing closer to his career line. You know, I don't know how realistic that was going into the season. I don't know what his projections were. I'm assuming they were roughly league average offense. But even that would be such a step up from what the Red Sox had at shortstop last year, and it's such a step up from what they are currently fielding out there now. And it just leaves the lineup so, not only leaves the lineup thin, but also robs it of a potential bounce back spot. So now you're in this place where you're already not expecting any real offense out of catcher. You're not expecting any real offense out of second base until hopefully Vaughn Grissom is healthy and productive. And, you know, he's just started his rehab assignment, so we'll see where that goes. You're not really expecting a whole lot of offense out of Rafaela, no matter where he's playing. You know, again, you were hoping maybe, just maybe, Story could find his, you know, find his old self if he could stay healthy and kind of get regular playing time for the first time in forever. Not going to be the case, obviously. And look, for whatever bad feelings I have about the Story contract, I don't have any bad feelings about Trevor Story, the person. It really sucks for him. The last 3 years of his career have been hell on earth.
It's not his fault. Like, were the one who did this. They were the Red Sox are the one who signed him. Like, no, it would just be a crappy situation if he did not get the contract that was offered to him and the market that he signed the contract in.
And on top of everything else, this is a dude who clearly worked his ass off to get back into playing shape, to get back to the field. Managed to do it last year, despite the fact that I he blew out an elbow ligament, you know, that I was astonished he even made it back to the.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Field in the first place, you know, to have him go down so quickly on such a fluke injury too, you know, to dive for a ball and just completely destroy your shoulder in the process, to say nothing about what the potential career ramifications of that are for him. Like, you know, as we've learned with pitchers and hitters, shoulder injuries rarely come out better on the other side. I mean, I don't think you ever come out better on the other side, but you know, it really ups the risk that he's just never going to be a productive major leaguer again. And that really stinks for a guy who, you know, plays hard, who you know, has the talent and capability to be an impact major leaguer. It just stinks all the way around. And it, you know, it's, yeah, it's a bummer. It's and look, this Red Sox team is just getting buffeted by injuries left and right, exposing the lack of depth that, you know, I think a lot of pretty much everyone projected was going to be the central issue for this team over the course of the season. But, you know, to have Story, after all he's gone through already, to have it happen to him so early in the season and just so it definitively be like, oh no, he's done for the year. You know, that it's hard to swallow. It really is.
Absolutely. Last thing here, we have to end on a positive note, which is the White Sox lineup.
How is that a positive note?
Because we're not fans of the White Sox, so we can laugh. What's been your favorite hilarious White Sox lineup card that you've seen to this point, John Taylor?
Cleanup hitter Kevin Pillar is astonishing. How on earth did that happen? I really have to think about this one. Jeez, again, cleanup hitter Kevin Pillar is really good. I think the fact that there was a lineup that had like seven shortstops in it.
Yeah.
Like all of them on the level of like Lennon Sosa, and like the fact that this team just signed Wilmer Defoe to a minor league deal the other day. It's like, you have like nine Wilmer Defoes. What do you need the actual Wilmer Defoe for? Wilmer Defoe, who I should note, hasn't been a major leaguer since like 2021 and has never been a good major leaguer at that. 2022. He managed to make 6 plate appearances for the Diamondbacks in 2022 and collected 0 hits. Like,
can I?
What are we doing? What are we doing if you're the Chicago White Sox?
Well, they're doing nothing. Jerry Reinsdorf, he said it, like, what else would I do? Which was an all-time great, hilarious owner quote of just like, what else would I be doing right now? Like, when friends are like, you're not good at this ownership thing. Are you sure you want to keep doing it? And he's like, what else am I going to do? Which is objectively hilarious all to itself. But John, I want you to close your eyes for a second.
Okay. Done.
Tover, Doyle, McMahon, Diaz, Montero, Bichard, Taglia, Trejo, Stallings.
Oh, the Rockies.
Is that a worse lineup than any White Sox lineup you've thought about in the last minute and a half?
I don't know. I mean,
this could be an all-time great battle between who can put out the worst lineups on any given day. The Rockies or the White Sox. This could be a really fun series. Look, I don't know who's going to win. This is something to monitor throughout the course of the year. Who can put out the worst lineup? The A's aren't even in the conversation right now.
The White Sox are equally pointless, I should note. Kevin Pillar has batted cleanup for this team twice. How does that happen? How do you get to this point? How do you get to this point where you are willingly penciling Paul DeJong into the lineup every day?
So you want here's some more stuff.
There are, I just want to know, okay, here's a fun one. How many White Sox players have a batting average over 200?
Two.
Okay, it's actually more than that, but I should note.
The fact that you asked, I'm just it's going to be two for any given lineup.
Let me note that how many guys have a batting average of 200? Luis Robert and Yoan Moncada are two of them, but obviously they're hurt.
I was going to say, they're not in the lineup right now.
For a while. Here are the guys hitting over 200 for the White Sox right now. Dominic Fletcher, Gavin Sheets, Corey Lee, Braden Shoemake, and Kevin Pillar. That's it. That is it.
That's terrible.
This is, it's like, what
Jack,
is the point
White
of
Sox Jack on Twitter said, through 16 games, the 2024 White Sox have a lower team OPS, which is 568, than Adam Dunn had in 2011. Imagine a lineup of 9 2011 Adam Dunns.
Sorry, you said their team OPS last year was this year is 568?
Yes.
Okay. Among qualified hitters last year, I'm just going to look this up because, I'm going to have to look at them. I'm going to have to look at standard numbers. No, not standard, advanced. Okay. Individual OPS. 568 would be 9 Tim Andersons. Javi Baez had a better OPS than that last year. Miles Straw had a higher OPS.
Oh my God.
It's basically a line.
Is there any White Sox hitter right now who would start on another team? Like a team that's fully healthy? Run Major League Baseball? Is there one who would start somewhere else?
No. On a good team? No. Absolutely not.
Oh my God.
Martin Maldonado has an OPS of 191.
They have five guys I saw today that are have a batting average lower than 171.
You have to try to make a team this bad. You have to try. You really have to try. It is such an indictment of everything the last 5 years for the White Sox have, or the last, I should say, 3 years for the White Sox have been. And again, as we noted from the start, this team made the playoffs in 2021. They won their division in 2021. That was not that long ago. We all have memories from that year. 3 years later, this is what they're reduced to because of an owner who just flat out does not care anymore.
Can I give you the White Sox? Okay, so this was on Twitter, Caleb, for Rookie of the Year on Twitter. I think he's a White Sox fan. White Sox all-time lineup since 2021. This is only 3 years, in the last 3 years, John.
Yeah, this is only three, because I really want to keep hammering this. It has only been 3 years since that team won the division.
Tim Anderson, Andrew Benintendi, Luis Robert, Jose Abreu, Eloy Jimenez, Yon Makata, Tommy Pham, Yasmani Grandal, Nick Madrigal.
None of those guys are still there except for Benintendi. Well, Robert and Moncada are still there, sort of, kind of. Eloy is still there, but who knows?
But that's like their all-time lineup. In the last 3 years, they could have all these guys still there. Like, this was a situation where it got bad quickly. They've had a lot of good players in the last 3 years, and they're all either gone or hurt.
Yeah.
They're all gone.
It's remarkable how mismanaged this team has been over the last 3 years. I mean, it's really amazing that the reality of this team is going to be worse than the A's, a team that is full stop not trying.
God.
Like, this is really something. And the funniest thing about this for the White Sox, with the draft lottery in existence, there's no guarantee this even leads to the number one pick.
I will say, I think Ozzie Guillen should do, like, TikToks of every White Sox game.
I think Ozzie Guillen should just manage the team. Why not?
No, he doesn't want it. He wants to get his takes off. He's hilarious. Like, Ozzie Guillen should be allowed to get a 2-minute ESPN, MLB Network, whatever, like, update on the Chicago White Sox. I would tune in for 2 minutes a day to, hey, Ozzie, what do you think about the White Sox today?
Yeah, it would just be the Korean groundskeepers from Major League just going, they're shit. Like, that's all it is. It's all like, what a pointless franchise, ultimately.
Yeah.
Like, which I wouldn't blame any White Sox fan if they just didn't bother this year. And I'm not
White Sox fans. You're not sitting there. There's not one white, even the best, like, Sox Machine is a great White Sox pod. There is no way they can do this. That's not good for your sanity, your personal life, your
because especially like they're what on this team, what on this roster right now, aside from Crochet, is something you can look forward to go, ah, a sign of the future. Like, when you're watching Martin Maldonado and Paul DeJong strike out,
they're
all the time,
old and bad. It's the worst combination. Yeah,
there's nothing here to look forward to. Nothing on this roster to dream on, with the exception of Crochet. And eventually, when he gets called up and sacrificed upon an altar of blood, Colson Montgomery, if they bother calling him up this year. But you're just watching so you can just, like, stare in disbelief that a team could be this bad on purpose, essentially. Both on purpose and by accident, because I would hope, if you ask Jerry Reinsdorf, hey, did you plan on this happening? He would hopefully go, no.
He didn't say, he was not planning about it, but like, what else am I going to do?
Like he said, what else is he going to do? Nicky Lopez is an OPS plus of 3.
Handsome guy, though.
Handsome dude. Paul DeJong has no walks on the season.
Braves legend Nicky Lopez.
He and Martin Maldonado have combined for a single walk in like 70 plate appearances. that's astonishing stuff.
Oh man, we'll end it there. Go Sox. John, yeah, Taylor, geez. Always a pleasure, my friend, and I will talk to you next week. So. All right, we're back here on the Chase Thomas podcast, where I'm now joined by the new Westlake High head football coach, Morris Mitchell. Morris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm good, Chase. How are you?
I'm pretty good. You know what's funny? So I'm curious if you get this all the time in your life, where your name, how many people go Mitchell Morris for you, yeah, and just hesitate on Morris Mitchell? Because I swear every time I looked at it, I think about it, and it's going to happen for the rest of the time we're doing this. And ooh, when I'm reading about you, I'm going to be like, Morris Mitchell, Mitchell Morris, Morris Mitchell, Mitchell. Like, is that common for you?
It is. It's quite common. Mm-hmm. I go by Morris because it was my grandfather's name. My grandfather is probably the greatest man I've ever known.
Mm-hmm.
When he passed away when I was 18, it was a homage to him to go by my middle name, which is Morris. And just to be able to show, like, he's still here, he's living through me, things of that nature, all of his teachings that he taught me, like, so it's all for him. So I get it all the time, like, Coach Morris, Coach, mm-hmm. you know, something of that nature, or Mitchell Morris or anything like that. So, you know, I've been quite used to it.
So are you saying you changed to Morris, like, when you turned 18, went by something different? Like, you grew up, people who grew up with you called you something different?
So, like, when I'm from Villarica, Georgia,
mm-hmm.
from a small town. And so everybody from Villarica, so this is how I know somebody knows me from Villarica.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Brinston.
Yeah.
And then when I hear that, I know, like, well, that's somebody who knows me. You know, not, hey, Morris, how are you? Or, hey, mm-hmm. Mo, how are you? Like, Brinston? I was okay. So
if I opened up with, like, hey, Brinston, how, like, you would have been like, whoa, who is this? How do you know that?
How do you know me? Like, mm-hmm. you know, so it's one of those deals for me. And so when I was leaving for college, that's when I decided to go by Morris. And I've been going by Morris since I was a freshman in college.
I don't think I've ever heard of anyone making the flip like that. It's almost like you became a new guy. You were adult. Legally, you were an adult. You're like, all right, I'm changing things up. I'm a little bit different here.
Completely different, though.
That's wild. This is what a great start, man. I have never heard that, but I love it. Well, you're recently married too, I saw. So does your wife go Brinston or does she go Morris? Like, that's a big question.
She calls me Bryn. So that was one of the deals when we started dating. I told her, you can't call me Brinston until, you know, we start dating officially. So,
okay.
So that was kind of one of the ground rules type of thing.
I love this. That's wild, man. I'm all about this. What are some other unknown facts here? So for the folks watching at home, parents, fans of Westlake, is there any other interesting things that people might not know about you yet?
Man, you know, like I said, I'm from Villarica, Georgia. I'm born and raised there. I graduated from Villarica High School. You know, like, I was a purple and gold through and through.
Mm-hmm.
Wildcat born, Wildcat bred. I stayed there until I was 18. At 18, I left. I had signed my letter of intent to play at Bluefield College in Virginia. I played there for one semester. I got up there. I started as a true freshman. I caught the first interception in 85 years, I believe. Yeah, I caught the first interception in 85 years there. I caught a deep post in the middle of the field at free safety.
Uh-huh.
Be quite honest, I hated it there. I was so ready to go.
Clearly, you were there a semester, and you're like, I'm out.
I called my mentor. My mentor, he actually is coming to coach with us. His name is Robbie Ridley. I called him and said, hey, man, you got to get me out of here, dude. I got to get out of here. So that December, I left to go to – I went home. In January, I transferred to West Hills Community College in California. I went to Coalinga, California. I went from Georgia, I went from Virginia back to Georgia to California. I was there for 11 months.
Okay.
And I played there. I was an all-conference performer, all the things. I got 31 scholarship offers coming off of that. This was back before transfer portal. So this is back when you had to get, like, the paper signed. I had to go in and get my clearance form signed so that my head coach would let me go. He asked me, are you going somewhere in the conference? I said, no, sir, I'm going to junior college. He said, okay, I'll sign it.
Mm.
Left. And so then I came back and I went to Shorter University after junior college. My first week at Shorter, I actually blew my knee out.
Mm.
I tore the cartilage completely off my leg.
That didn't sound fun.
No, when I was 6 weeks non-weight bearing, I had to relearn how to walk, relearn how to run. All the things, I came back and I was an all right football player there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I went on to play Canadian Football League football. I played for the Edmonton Eskimos. And then from there, I played the National Arena Football League for about a month. And then after that, I started coaching. I got started as a ninth grade assistant in Union Grove High School. So that's me in a nutshell from that to here.
There you go. I think Kelsey Pope, Tennessee's wide receiver coach, he had a stop at Shorter too. I feel like Shorter has a bunch of coaches. They put out a bunch of coaches, and you included here.
Yeah, Kelsey Pope was there like probably about a year and a half after I graduated. He was there. Me and him, we've connected when I went back up on the hill. We actually just talked like a couple of weeks ago. He called me while I was on vacation. So I, you know, Kelsey's a good guy. He's one of my good friends.
I love that. What has the transition been like? Obviously, you get the head coaching job here this spring, coach. So what has it been like adjusting at this time, time of year?
Man, to be quite honest with you, it's really busy.
Mm-hmm.
It's more organization than anything else. You know, the kids have been fantastic. The kids from the time I was named the interim head coach to now I got named the head coach, they've done everything I've asked them to do, from working on their grades to being in class to doing all the workouts that I'm asking them to do, getting up here early and things of that nature. So that's been the easy part. It's coaching football. Coaching football is always the easiest part, but the hardest part has just been the organization, just making sure that everything's running right, getting the things how I want it. Me and Coach Zachary coached together for a very long time. He gave me my first shot as a varsity head coach when I was at Billy Ricker High School. And so I knew like some of the things that he was going through because he's like a big brother to me, so we talked a lot. But when you actually have to sit in the seat, is you making the decisions and is you doing all the things, like it becomes very busy. It becomes very time consuming. So one of the things I've stolen from Brent Key, who's a head football coach at Georgia Tech, is to sit down and reflect on my day.
Yeah.
So I sit down and I write down bullet points of what I've done in the day. So then when I get to a certain situation like this later on in my career, I can go back to it and be like, well, this is what I did my first year.
So do you do this in the morning, like your first thing, or is it like in the afternoon or at the evening, like you reflect on your day? Like how does that work?
I honestly try to do it throughout the day. So I walk around, now I walk around with this notebook and I just sit down with it and put down bullet points. Like for example, right before you got on the call, I was in a meeting with my treasurer at my booster club, and I just wrote down like, meeting with treasurer. We talked about this, and that was it.
Yeah.
So it's some of those. It's something I get to do throughout the day to be able to get it done.
Well, it also retains. Like I'm definitely like I'm the same way. Like I take all kinds of handwritten notes, and I like one of those things. I mean, we were. I think we're around the same age. I'm in my mid 30s here, coach, and I what you?
I'm 29.
You're what?
I'm 29.
29? Dang.
I'm 29.
I would have said like 30, like early 30s.
I turned 30 in next month.
Hold on. You're 30. You don't get 29 anymore. I turn 33 tomorrow. You're hanging on to 29. You're basically 30.
It's time to go.
Hey, I'm going to tell you, as someone in their 30s, like it's fun. I love being in my 30s. 30s is so much easier. You know who you are. And you're like, I'm being married, two married guys here. That's nice. Like it's just nice. Like you have a routine, you have a system. It's just, you get through a lot of it that I don't miss at all in my 20s. Like,
yes, for sure.
Yeah, no, I'm 100% with you. But I think it's interesting too, because when you make that transition and you getting into this at 29, like I think one of the hardest parts when I talk to so many different coaches is like, how do they take their foot off the gas of what, if they're defensive minded, if they're a defensive coordinator, or offensive coordinator for years and they're promoted or they take this job as a head coach, like CEO, for you, like, is that one of the things you're most worried about stepping in as the head coach, where you were like, you know, this is just a lot, on your plate as a young coach? Like, are you ready to make that jump, or did you feel like you were ready when Coach Zachary left?
Honestly, I felt like I was ready. Me and Coach Zachary have had these conversations a plethora of times when I have interviewed for jobs and I didn't get them. What? Like, you're ready, you know, like you can do it, blah, blah, blah. And so I felt like I was ready. I was just looking for a shot. You get what I'm saying? So for me, like, that was one of the biggest things, was like, I've been preparing for this. That was one of the reasons why I was at a fork in the road when I first started coaching. Mm-hmm. It's either go back and play or continue to keep coaching.
Yeah.
And so for me, like, I got the same feeling that I get when I was getting ready to play, getting ready to go coach. So I was like, well, this is God telling me, like, it's time to go put this down and go coach. So for me, like, I just started from there, and I just started. I'm a process type guy. Mm-hmm. I like looking at people's processes, studying them, looking at different things. Like, I look at, like in January, I studied Kobe Bryant for the entire month of January.
Okay.
I just looked at YouTube and read books and looked at interviews and things of that nature, and just studying people and their processes, and started putting it into like my mental bank. And just was like, okay, like, this is something I can pull from.
What was your favorite thing you pulled from for Kobe?
To be quite honest, it was, so he had a contract for himself with summer strength and conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
It was like a non-negotiable.
Yeah.
I'm doing these workouts with this conditioning, and it's a non-negotiable. And he signed it himself.
Huh.
Like, he made a contract for himself and signed it himself. So like for me, like, I took that as like a form of discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So from that perspective, I'm like, yeah, man, like, if it's something I have to do or something that I get to do, I need to sign a contract with myself and keep myself disciplined to be able to go out there and go do it.
I love it. What did Coach Zachary, what's the best piece of advice he left you with before he moved on to ECU?
To be quite honest, it was probably the last thing he said to me.
Okay.
He said, take the bull by the horns and treat this thing like the Super Bowl. Go coach like it's the Super Bowl every single day and go get this job. That's what he told me. Me and Coach Zachary, we got a very special relationship. He's like a big brother to me. So I knew that he was leaving before everybody else did. He pulled me in right before he met with everybody else. He said, look, this is what's going on. This is what's happening. This is what we're doing. And I need you to go get this job. And he was in my ear the entire process. Like, if I had a question, he'd answer it. Even to this day, like, if I was to text him right now, he's going to get back to me and tell me what he thinks. Mm. So it's been a blessing to have him in my corner, for him to push me, guide me. Like, there's no amount of thanks that I could not give to Rico Zachary. He's top tier in my book.
I love that. What do you love the pressure of keeping the playoff streak alive as you're going in here? Like, is that in the back of your mind that there's an established pedigree here and that Westlake football is serious?
I don't believe in pressure.
Okay.
I don't. Like, the people tell me all the time, like somebody asked me that same question yesterday. They asked, is it pressure? I don't feel it. I don't. Because honestly, like, I believe if we develop our players correctly, if we continue to keep doing the things that we're doing and continue to keep harping on the little things and the details, the wins are going to take care of themselves. Just like Bill Walsh said, like, the wins are going to take care of themselves. But you got to make sure you're doing the right things on a day-to-day basis. I got to win today. I can't worry about – we play Langston game one.
Yeah,
I can't worry about August and April. Like, and now I'm missing May, June, July. Like, I can't think about that. So I don't feel any pressure. It doesn't really matter to me. And I really believe that our players see that from me, because I don't talk about it. I don't put an emphasis on it. They're only going to attract what I put an emphasis on. If I put an emphasis on today, they won't only think about today.
I like it. When you, like, as a defensive back, that's the position that you obviously played a lot of. That's where you came into defense. I'm curious because, like, when you're defining your personal defensive style, your scheme that you're most comfortable with and keeping an eye on things, was it hard to make that adjustment of, like, I got to keep my eyes on the defensive line. I got to keep my eyes on the linebackers. I've got to kind of evolve because your eyes are naturally drawn to what your DBs are doing. Like, did that take some time for you? It seems like it did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, like, I started prepping to be a DC before I was a DC. Mm. So, like, I tried to start asking questions prior. That's one of my things, is, like, being prepped and things of that nature. So I started asking questions, like, I sat down with our D-line coach when I was at Alexander and talked to him about D-line play. I would go to clinics to look at other positions. Like, I wasn't going for the DB clinic. I wasn't doing that. Like, I know enough about DB. Like, and if I don't know enough, I'll go ask for it. But I went to go see other positions, and I would see, like, how coaches talk their position and do the things at their position. Like, even to the day, like, I'll sit down with all our coaches and just sit down and pick their brains, because I know I don't know everything about football, but I try to at least have some type of catalog that I pull from in order to do that. So it wasn't really like a tough transition once I became a defensive coordinator, but it was one of those, like, as I started prepping, I was wondering, like, how coaches, like, see everything.
Mm-hmm.
How is it that you see – you're standing here with me, but you saw that outside linebacker not take his right step. Like, how did you see that? That was always my question.
Mm. And that – do you feel pretty comfortable now, or do you think it's still a continued process that it's just going to take some time as head coach to continue to see everything?
It's a continued process. It's a continued process, because you just – this game is just something that you're just not going to always know what everything is going on. Like, you just got to continue to keep educating yourself. I take a lot of time in doing that, continue to keep educating myself. And you also have to just continue to keep relying on your coaches as well. Like, I will look at things at how does a coach correct something?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll look at, so, like, for example, like, if our left guard doesn't do something and our O-line coach has some trigger cues that he starts coaching, I'll listen to those trigger cues. So then the next time I see that same interaction, like, I'm like, okay, well, coach, he didn't do it that time either. It's like, what are we giving it to him? Like, how you just gave it to him, you know? So that's what I try to start looking at and start listening to, is just the coaching cues. And now that I have to look at the whole program, that's why I brought up the left guard example. Like, I have to listen to those coaches' cues as well. Defensively, I only had to worry about D-line linebackers and DBs. Like, okay. Yeah. So now I got to look at everybody.
So when you are looking at everybody and you're trying to put your own stamp on the Westlake program, like, do you think it's still fluid that you could see your scheme changing year to year depending on your personnel? Do you have something that you're more comfortable with that you're kind of excited about unveiling? Like, how much of that is just what you learned from Coach Zachary, and how much of that is, like, things that you want to put your own imprint on?
So there's a lot of things, like, that will be structurally still the same. We have a great foundation here at Westlake underneath what Coach Zachary did before he left here. So there's a lot of things structurally that continue to stay the same. Obviously, like, you know, there are going to be some things that we throw in that are going to be different than what people have seen. And that's going to be my own stamp. Like, one of the things that I continue to keep talking about with our players is just how we do things together, how we do things as a unit, as one team. You know, one of the slogans that I really take key to is the greatest reward is team. Grit. That's grit. The greatest reward is the team. And everything that we're doing is for the team. We're giving to the team. We're giving relentless effort to the team. We're having integrity for the team. And everything is for the team. And so for that perspective, like, we already had a team mantra last year, but that's how I go even further into it. That's my stamp. Is how we go even further into the details of making sure that the kids know that we're Westlake, we're the Westlake Lions. We're not just a bunch of individuals that play at Westlake. Because I think that sometimes that's been the kind of the deal here. Like, we have kids, they get offers, they're big time, all this, that, and the third. But it really doesn't matter if we're not one unit. You know, that's how we're going to get to the next level of being able to compete for a state championship every year.
I love it. Is Langston Hughes the game you're most excited for this fall? I know you're not about pressure. I know we're a process over results and everything else, but is that the game you have circled? Is there another game that you've got circled? Which one are you most excited about as your first year as head coach?
To be honest, like, I really don't have any of them circled as a
record. Okay.
I haven't really looked that far into it, you know, and to be able to say, like, yeah, this one's going to be a big one, August 3rd. I'm a 1-0 type guy.
Okay.
I just want to go 1-0 every week. So it's one of those types of deals. Like, I'm not going to sit up here and be jumping off the roof and jumping through walls and things of that nature because of one game or this, that, the third. I want to go 1-0 every week. And I feel like we go 1-0 every week, we'll wind up being 15-0.
I love that. What do you think the fan base, though, based on who you've talked to and the players and everything else, what do you think that they're, if you had to poll them, what do you think they're most excited about?
They love that Langston game.
Yeah.
They love it because it's South Fulton. It's South Fulton, man. These are the kids that they've been playing against since they were pups. These are kids, these are the parents that they've been hanging out with. They were at Welcome All Park, Ben Hill, Atlanta Vikings, in Sandtown Vikings and all these different things. So they really love that game. You know, they're going to put a lot into it. So we're going to have to do a good job of being able to keep our players focused on what's the main thing, which is just playing the game. You know, all the hoopla is going to be out there. We're playing on a Saturday that first week in August. And we're going to have to just continue to keep focusing on that.
I love it. Away from the game a little bit, what are you talk about, like, things you've gotten into, watching Kobe videos, picking people's brains, reading different things. Like, what are you reading now? Is there anything specific that you're reading right now that you like?
Audiobook type guy.
You're an audiobook kind of guy?
Yeah, I'm an audiobook.
Okay, what's the audiobook type right now?
So right now is Elevate and Dominate by Deion Sanders. Right now, that's what I'm listening to. I take notes on that book as well. You know, it's one of those things that I do. I love to listen to books while I'm riding in the car, but then I also know that it's dangerous for me to listen to books to ride in the car because I like taking notes.
Oh, you're taking notes while you're driving in the car.
Yeah, I tried, and that's why I stopped doing it.
Yeah, that's it.
I just saw myself doing this, that, and the third, so I was like, yeah, I got to stop doing that. But that's the book that I'm listening to right now. I also spend a lot of time. I take pride in the way I look, so I've been working out. I work out, so I get here early. I usually, if I ask the kids to get here at 6:30, I'm here at 5:30.
Okay. How much sleep are you getting? If you're getting there at 5:30, you're getting up early then.
I'm probably getting up at like 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah.
Are you doing coffee? What are we doing?
I drink coffee. I drink one thing.
That's it for the whole day?
For the whole day.
What do you do? What do you do? Are we doing like cream? Are we doing sugar? Is it straight? Like, is it just black coffee? Cream. What is it?
Vanilla cream type of guy.
Okay.
Vanilla cream, no sugar. No sugar, just one cup of coffee. On a game day,
yeah,
I drink Red Bull.
Are we doing sugar free or are we doing sugar Red Bull?
Oh no, I got the sugar in the Red Bull now.
You got to have the sugar in the Red Bull or no?
I do have to have sugar.
Oh, okay.
What is it that I usually get either the yellow can or the red can? Those are my two go tos. My wife,
you don't go original there.
Nah, I gotta get the flavors.
Okay.
Watermelon. I forget what the yellow one's called.
I know what you're talking about.
What else do I do? I like hanging out with my family. My family's big for me. Usually on the weekends, I just leave that open for my family. Like, I don't do anything. And my wife picks everything for the weekend. Like, if she wants to do something, we'll do it.
Okay.
Also, like, I will go to church. Mm-hmm. On Sunday, we go to Live Atlanta. Church in Sandy Springs, and we typically have a good time. I'm a very laid back type of guy. Like, I don't really do too much. I just try to keep a slow lifestyle as much as I can.
what's been your favorite date night of late? If you're not planning everything, is there a certain spot in Villarica that you like a lot that you and your wife like? Is there a certain kind of restaurant or food that you prefer to do or no?
I'm on a lamb kick right now.
Lamb.
Yeah, I'm eating lamb. Like, every
like time cooking or going out for lamb? Yeah,
like every time we go somewhere, like,
yeah,
I'm typically getting lamb, like, right now. And before that, it was salmon.
Okay.
Right now, I'm eating lamb chops. Our anniversary was just last month. It was March 19th.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And my wife picked for us to do, like, homemade rugs.
Homemade what?
Homemade rugs.
Like rugs to walk on, like rugs.
Yeah, so like it gave you like a platform to be able to make a rug. You had a little done with yarn, and you make a rug.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, it was top tier. Like, it was top tier. I had to give it to my wife. It was top tier.
How long did this take?
We were probably there for like maybe, yeah, like 5 hours to get it done. I got it done in like 3.
5 hours, 3 hours. Like, so what are y'all talking throughout all this? Are you like taking breaks? Is this intense? Is it like a race type deal?
I'm sweating.
Yeah.
I had my hat turned backwards. I'm sweating trying to get it done. I was in my coaching stance, like, trying to get all the details I want. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was a good deal. You know?
Did y'all do your own or did y'all combine and do one big rug?
We did our own. So she had one and I had one.
Whose was better, honestly?
I would say hers was better. She did a Georgia Peach and then okay. I did the Atlanta Braves logo.
Okay. So logos and everything. Did you keep them? Are they in the house? They're good to go long term?
Yeah, they mailed them to us and we were able to keep them in there and out. I wanted to do a Westlake logo. I asked her, I said, they got Westlake.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no.
I love it. Couple quick things before we go. I mean, when you think about this fall or this summer, I should say, what is the position battle that you're most excited about watching your guys fight? Or when you look at the depth chart and you think about where the roster is right now, what position battle are you most excited seeing playing out over the next couple months?
Honestly, it'll probably be running back.
Hmm.
We got two really good running backs. We got Naeemo Denny and Tamir Bransford. Tamir Bransford is a very good player. He's explosive. He's big. He can run. Like, he's got all the tools and all the things. But then also, we got Naeemo Denny. He's about 5'9", about 185 pounds. He power cleans 265 right now. He's been very reliable and dependable and something that you look for in every kid. And he just works hard. So from that perspective, like, you got the best of both worlds here as far as both of them are top-tier athletes. And then one works really hard and the other one has a whole bunch of talent. And then from that perspective, like, to see them both just come in and go to work every day, whatever that looks like, I'm just want to see, like, how we're going to get the best out of this whole thing.
I love it. Final thing, and we'll get you out of here, Coach.
Yes, sir.
Your ideal at spring break season here in the school system and everything else, you get to pick your own spring break. Go wherever you want to go with your wife. Where's your number one destination right now?
We're probably going back to Hawaii.
Oh, my wife and I are thinking about doing that this summer.
So we went to Hawaii probably about three years ago. We went to Hawaii. My wife is actually originally from Hawaii.
Okay.
So we didn't do touristy things.
Yeah.
We did the local things and it was top tier. Like my father-in-law was in the military. He retired from the military. He did 20 years and then he just did 20 years on the civilian side. So he's a great example for me as well. But they literally lived in Hawaii from the time she was born to the time she was 13. And from there, like, we went out, we hiked up the highest mountain on the main island. We also went to the flea market. So the one fact about Hawaii, so the flea market is at Aloha Stadium.
Okay.
So we went to Aloha. I had to creep in and see what the field looked like, you know, still see if it looks good and things of that nature. But it's one of those types of things. And then, like, the food, if you ever go out to Hawaii, you have to eat Hawaiian food, like Portuguese sausage with rice and eggs. She likes spam musubi and chicken katsu.
I've heard spam's huge in Hawaii. I've heard it's huge. Yeah.
They love it out there. And so I never knew how big it was or how good it was until I went out there. And now, anytime we go to the West Coast, we're usually getting some type of Hawaiian food.
I love that. Yeah, it's exciting. But the last thing, I'm worried about the flight. Or how was the flight there and back? Were you pretty, like, is it kind of a drag, like, to get through the Hawaii there and back?
So we flew into Denver. You know, that's probably like a 3-hour flight. So it's not that bad. It's another 5 to 6 hours on that plane to cross that water. Like, I think I woke up probably like 3 or 4 times and we're still on the plane. I'm like, oh, are we there yet? But once you get there, obviously, like, the time change is something completely different because it's like 6-hour difference from us.
Yes.
So, but once you get over there, it's a great time. I advise anybody, if you ever get a chance to go to Hawaii, you should go.
I love it. Coach, how do the good folks support the Westlake football program this spring as you get things underway here with summer ball and everything else?
You can always follow our our social media platforms. We have our at Recruit Westlake football page that is on Twitter. Mm-hmm. It's at Recruit Westlake. And then we have the football Westlake underscore football on Instagram. And then you can always follow me on either one of those platforms. It's at Coach Mo 25. At Coach Mo 25, you can always follow me on any of those platforms. You know, we would love to have anybody support. Everybody can, is willing to come to South Fulton to come watch those Westlake Lions. You can come on anytime. Come watch us practice. Come watch us play. We have great kids. We have great community. We just want to continue to keep developing each and every day.
I love it. You're going to do great, Coach, and I'm excited, like, especially some of the uniforms, like what y'all wore at Cedar Grove last year, those gray silver.
Yeah.
Those are some, there's some good looking uniforms at Westlake.
There are. We got some special things coming out that's going to get ready to make things even better here at Westlake. So y'all be on the lookout.
I love it. Coach, good luck this spring and summer, and we'll have to do this again soon.
Thank you, Chase. You can come. We can talk anytime. Just leave
me. All right. I will do. Thanks, Coach.
Thank you, Chase.
Nicely done, nephew. Chase Thomas Podcast. Hell yeah.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.